Yesterday we spoke to Megan Davis, Professor Davis, about the winding path towards reconciliation that we've been walking since the turn of the century. Certainly no yellow brick road. But it's in one area, perhaps more than any other, that we've seriously failed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians over the past two decades, and that's in reducing imprisonment rates and putting an end to deaths in custody. Indigenous Australians are vastly overrepresented in the prison population, and as we discussed on the program back in June, there have been over 430 deaths in custody since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody in 1991. Early this year, Labor Senator Pat Dodson gave a passionate speech in the Senate calling for change. Let's hear a little of what Pat had to say.
For too long, nice words, good intentions, but the lack of action and commitment has not seen a reduction to the custodies or the deaths in custodies. It's seen a escalation in the social indicators that diminish First Nations people and diminish us as a nation. It diminishes us as a nation because we are incapable of dealing with it. So I ask the government to sincerely put to practice the best intentions into commitments and into real working and commitments with the First Nations peoples and get real agreements with the states. And don't pussyfoot around with the states, say, oh, it's the state's responsibility. Well, we know this. You've been capable of finding ways of dealing with this. Now's the time to stop the rot of First Nations dying in custody, being over-imprisoned, and their children being put into out-of-care home.
Joining me to discuss this are Tony McAvoy, SC, Dr. Hannah McGlad, and Keenan Mundine. Tony is Australia's first Indigenous silk, and he's held many positions concerning Indigenous affairs, including as co-senior counsel assisting the Royal Commission into the protection and detention of children in the Northern Territory. Hannah McGlad is a Noongar woman from Western Australia, an associate professor at the Curtin University Law School, and an expert member of the United Nations Permanent Forum for Indigenous Issues, which is been much discussed on the program of late. Keenan Mundine, co-founder of Deadly Connections, a non-profit that works with Aboriginal youth. Tony, Hannah, Keenan, welcome to the Little Wireless program. Keenan, let's start by you telling us about your own experiences with our criminal justice system, because it was in the early 2000s that you first went into juvenile detention, and you said that after that you were in and out so often that you couldn't count them on your fingers and toes.
Yeah. I think what also needs to be explained is the circumstances before me entering the criminal justice system. So I was born and raised in Redfern, on the block here in Sydney. And at a very young age, I lost both of my parents and I was separated from my two older siblings and placed into kinship care. So I had a lot of challenges as a young boy trying to find my way in my community and in my family, and that led me to, you know, going to the streets and experimenting as a teenager and getting caught in the criminal justice system. But once I entered the criminal justice system, it was an easier sort of process to go back. You know, I was desensitized to the process. 14 years old, being strip searched by three grown men, you know, really broke my spirit and broke you know, my hope in having a better life than the one that I was living. And it sort of played a part in me accepting that process and the criminal justice system as a part of my life. And going into these institutions, not many people understand that even when you're, you know, detained in detention centers, they're not experts to deal with social problems. They're just there for punitive measures to make sure that you're abiding by center rules and regulations. And if not, you get further punished while being in there.
And you make the point that there's no consideration of culture. And I understand that early intervention programs in prisons were one size fits all.
Yeah. So most of the programs were mainly individualistic focused around, committing offences and doing illegal contact, illegal activity. There was nothing around, overcoming poverty, marginalisation, unemployment, none of these things that were sort of practical pathways in you overcoming your circumstances in the community.
So you spent the better part of your teenage years and early adulthood cycling in and out of detention, and you observed that about 80% of the people in detention were Indigenous and had similar backgrounds to yourself.
Yeah, so many of the young boys that I was detained in juvenile detention that had similar circumstances to me, they come from poor communities. Their mum and dads weren't able to support them to the best of their capabilities, ended up graduating and moving on to adult imprisonment with me. And most of, those Aboriginal boys are now men with children themselves and unfortunately are still trapped in that vicious cycle without hope of any way of living a normal life, man.
How the hell did you get out of it?
Oh man, it was one day at a time, but I met a very significant female who supported me and made me feel connected and made me feel normal. And, the biggest thing I talk about when I share my story is, I was just a little boy who wanted to be safe, who wanted to have food, who wanted to have clothes and, bikes and all of these things. And not once did I envisage that I would grow up to be a heroin addict and commit crimes and be in and out of prison and be homeless. So I think that sort of trauma response of me having that hope was still alive in me through all of my years and all of my detention. And when I found the right person to be able to support me and identify, some of the struggles within my community that re-traumatized me and get me to relapse and fall back into drugs, I was able to get back into football and culture and back to my family. And, I take it one day at a time.
Hannah, I was distressed to learn that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are actually the fastest growing prison sector.
Yes, it has been that way for a long time now. There's a lot of racism and discrimination against Aboriginal women through the criminal justice system, including in policing, particularly being over-policed as, potential offenders, and yet terribly under-policed as victims. And we see shocking cases, including, for example, the case of Tamika Mullaly, who was a victim of a severe violent assault by her partner. And when the police came, instead of letting her go immediately to the hospital where she needed to be, they actually arrested her. And Aboriginal women aren't calling the police because the risk is that children will be removed, or in fact, they may be perceived to be the aggressor and charged themselves. So it's, it is systemic racism that's happening in Australia today. And the risk to the children, of course, is you incarcerate the mother, the children then have to enter into a horrific out-of-home care system, which, puts them at risk very often. And, this really should be a measure of last resort, as the Royal Commission said many years ago.
Well, looking at the Australian Law Reforms Commission's Pathways to Justice report, that's 2018, I think, they list the significant drivers leading to Aboriginal women's incarceration: family violence, sexual abuse, mental health, cognitive impairment, poverty, homelessness. It's a terrible, terrible story, isn't it?
It really is. And, the statistics are shocking, and these are real lives, Aboriginal women and mothers' lives. In West Australia, Aboriginal mothers are more than 17 times more likely to be a victim of homicide, leaving children without their mums and, harmed for life as a result. So we really have to invest into violence against Indigenous women, which is not just about, interpersonal violence. This is about intergenerational trauma. This is about systemic and structural discrimination and racism that Indigenous women and men are experiencing. And this is certainly also leading to high incarceration rates of Aboriginal men. So the violence issue has to be tackled, but unfortunately the state wants to turn a blind eye and, really isn't listening to good human rights advice, including of UN treaty bodies who are calling for a specific national action plan on violence to Indigenous women and children.
That's the voice of Dr. Hannah McGlade. And now let's welcome to the bosom of the family Tony McAvoy. Tony, do you think unconscious bias plays a significant role in the overrepresentation of Indigenous Australians?
It certainly does, Philip. We have always known that there's a significant overrepresentation of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people in the justice system because of this unconscious bias, but it's been able to be measured recently with the release of a report from ANU scholar named Siddharth Shirodker, who in May this year identified that 3 out of 4 Australians had a negative, unconscious or implicit bias against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That correlates very closely with what I hear from the community about the way in which we're treated. And you see it in the exercise of discretion by the many players in the justice sector. So the circumstances that Dr. Hannah McGlade was just speaking of, where women are fearful of arrest from calling the police to a domestic violence scenario. The officers who attend in those circumstances have a discretion as to who they will place under arrest, how they will deal with the reports made to them, and who they will take to the police station, who they will grant police bail to, and so on.
I'm fascinated by something in my briefing notes here that I'll read out. It is said that Aboriginal drivers receive 3.2 times more fines from being pulled over by police than non-Aboriginal drivers, but fewer penalties on average when tickets are issued by traffic cameras. What a dramatic demonstration of unconscious bias.
West Australia.
Yeah, they are figures that have come out of an internal report that was done by the Western Australian Police Service. It was only made available, I think, on a Freedom of Information request. And the data is entirely consistent with the report from Siddharth Shirodker. This report is just a peek into how it operates in real terms. We don't have that data. We don't usually get access to that data, but that that data in relation to traffic offences, I think, can be extended throughout the range of discretions that the police exercise.
Tony, I'd like to go back to Australia's version of Abu Ghraib, and I'm thinking of the Don Dale Royal Commission. So the ABC airs that Four Corners, Australia's Shame. You acted as senior co-counsel assisting that Royal Commission. Could you share some of your reflections on that experience and remind the Gladys what the Commission revealed?
Well, at its heart, the Royal Commission revealed that the way in which the youth detention system in the Northern Territory operated was one in which they treated the young people as adults and engaged in punitive behaviour. And all of the research tells us that this is entirely the opposite of what you should be doing with young offenders. You should be placing them into a therapeutic environment with the hope that they will be able to make some advances during their time in detention and be able to do the things that Keenan talked about and finding their way once they get out. But by applying this punitive approach, they are almost signing the warrant for those children's progression to adult jails. And we heard evidence from young people about the guards making jokes about how they, when they turned 18, they would be straight into the adult prison with the adults. And it was such a heartbreaking commission to be involved in. There are many aspects of it. You know, the guards were bribing the children to fight each other with coke and chocolate bars. I mean, it's such errant behaviour from supposed adults in charge of young people is really shameful. And the fact that it went on for an extended period of time, the Royal Commission observed the conduct in the youth detention centres over a 10-year period. It was not as though there were isolated events. It was a course of conduct that really continued, but escalated towards the end of that 10-year period.
Tony, did you get the impression the bureaucracy wanted to see the system change?
Certainly the bureaucracy were resistant, it appeared to me, to the Royal Commission. And it's hard to say that they appeared to be particularly interested in change. I mean, there were some officers of the Northern Territory government who came and gave evidence about some progress that was occurring. But at the same time, we had officers who were currently working in the system and being complained of by people who were witnesses and still in the system. And we weren't able to protect those young people in any particular way. They were stuck in the system.
Tony, the NT government recently decided to build a new youth detention centre besides Darwin's adult jail, despite the Royal Commission saying the facility should not be rebuilt in close proximity.
That was particularly heartbreaking for all people that were involved in the Royal Commission. It's a signal that the Northern Territory government is placing other factors ahead of the welfare of these children. The point of this recommendation that a new detention centre be built but not in close proximity to the adult centre was so that this nexus between youth detention and adult detention could be broken. And clearly, that's not the case. It's also a concern that the proposed centre is of such a size that indicates that they're expecting to keep large numbers of children, young people, in detention in Darwin, where many of the young people involved come from communities outside of Darwin, and much of the report was directed towards trying to recommend to the Northern Territory government that young people are best supported in their own communities by community-led solutions, their own community, rather than being removed from their community and placed in detention centres, sometimes many thousands of miles from their home.
Hannah, Don Dale was just one of any number of investigations into such issues taking place over the past 20 years. Have we developed a culture of reporting in lieu of doing?
It seems that way. I mean, the Australian Law Reform Commission's Pathways to Justice report was handed to Parliament in late 2018, and there's been no implementation, really, of key recommendations of that report, in particular that states need to develop Aboriginal justice agreements and re-establish the Aboriginal Justice Advisory Committees, which were also flowing from the Royal Commission 30 years ago and which were disbanded, including, unfortunately, in my state where Senator Pat Dodson is speaking so strongly on these issues. But we're not seeing that will, political will, at the state government level and from an ALP government, which says it's committed to reconciliation. That's really shocking. We've now got law that's going to pass Parliament here tomorrow that will breach the human rights of Aboriginal children and families, child protection law that will undermine Aboriginal child placement principle, and it's going ahead in opposition from Aboriginal peak bodies and even UNICEF recently.
Hannah, I am agog and aghast at what you've just said. Tell me about this.
The West Australia government is amending child protection legislation and key provisions concerning Aboriginal children. Aboriginal stakeholders, including peak bodies at the local and national level, are arguing for human rights law reform consistent with best practice in Queensland and Victoria. And that entails giving Aboriginal families a right to participate and be heard in decision-making before decisions like child removal happen or placement. And we've had a lot of opposition. So we're arguing for Aboriginal family-led decision-making. And they're also watering down the Aboriginal child placement principle by placing non-Indigenous people before Aboriginal relatives of children who may not live in the proximity. So that is really quite actually shocking. The Aboriginal child placement principle came from the Bringing Them Home inquiry, which, you know, looked at all the removal across Australia that had happened under these past policies that were based on assimilation, based on terribly offensive eugenics principles, and were found to be actually genocide because clearly Aboriginal kids were being removed for the clear stated purpose, government purpose, of ending the Aboriginal culture and people as a race of people.
Last night when I was talking to Megan, she made the point that there are some very significant individual politicians who tried to do the right thing, and we gave a call out to Fred Chaney. But it seems to me that, and this is to you, Tony, that that's the pattern. You will see individual politicians doing or trying to do the right thing, but not much overarching leadership.
That's the eternal problem for First Nations people in this country. We are small in number, comparatively speaking, and even though our status as the first Australians entitles us under international law norms to certain treatment, to our prior informed consent and to the right to self-determination, that doesn't equate to any particular power in the political system that we have. And so our issues tend to end up at the margins, and we get overtaken by other issues which politicians seem to find more interesting.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National, and my guest, Tony McAvoy, SC, Australia's first Indigenous silk, Dr. Hannah McGlade, Associate Professor at the Curtin University School of Law, and Keenan Mundine, who grew up in Redfern, and as we know from his previous contributions to the program, has had all too many contacts with the criminal justice system. So back to you, Ken. You started your non-profit Deadly Connection to fill the gap that we've been describing, and you did it without financial support for 2 years. Tell me about you and Deadly Connection.
Yeah, so myself and my wife have co-founded Deadly Connections together, and that is to provide interventions that are culturally appropriate and responsive to community needs. My wife has a master's in criminology and a background in social work. Myself, before starting Deadly Connections, worked for non-government organisations, but white organisations, and they were really sort of missing the mark. You know, their intentions were great. What they wanted to offer was great, but it wasn't really digging into the deeper causes which entrench our people in child protection and justice issues. So we took the hard approach and volunteered to be able to get all of our frameworks together, to get all of our structures and all of the due diligence stuff that needs to be done when operating a charity, whilst doing fee-for-service, frontline, grassroots delivery, doing mentoring, doing advocacy. And it's 2 years now. We've had our two-year anniversary. We're supporting over 50 families, 20 individuals, about 20 young people that are at risk of being expelled or suspended from school, and keeping them engaged. So we're trying to fill these gaps and work in life stages. You know, most charities and not-profits, they have very strict contingencies and criteria when working with our mob, particularly age group, charges, offences, orientation, male or female, where we take a life course approach and given the research and the stats around our people, we support them even if they do fall off the tracks.
Keenan, how are you being funded now?
So we were very, very high profile in the Black Lives Matter movement, because we are, from research and the way in which we build our organisation, the only justice and child protection focused First Nations led community-controlled, Aboriginal community-controlled organisation. So we got significant funding through the Black Lives Matter sort of movement. We also get a lot of funding from philanthropy and philanthropic organisations that want to give money to grassroots charities. We do get a little bit of government funding, but I think that's not even 5% of our budget. So we rely heavily on donations and philanthropy.
Hannah, a while ago we were discussing raising the age of criminal responsibility on the program. It was before the last meeting of the Attorneys General. But I understand efforts stalled again at that meeting, and now we're awaiting yet another report. So let's talk about the age of criminal responsibility across the country, stuck at 10 years of age?
It's really shocking, isn't it? You know, it's one of the lowest ages in the world. And I've appeared before the last two reviews of Australia by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, and they make it very clear to the government this is completely unacceptable and you need to increase the age to at least 14 years. We see the ACT government showed some leadership recently, and they're the first jurisdiction to make that commitment. What are we doing in this country that we can start criminalising children, mainly Aboriginal children? And I think, you know, that absolute heartlessness there is a really shocking indictment on our nation. Where did the reconciliation, the 10-year statutory reconciliation process, really lead us when, you know, this is the sort of battles that we're still seeing today? And we know that that youth detention centre and the, you know, the child removal are so closely intertwined. The Australian Law Reform Commission certainly called for an inquiry into the connection, and that was also ignored.
Keenan, how important is this minimum age of criminal responsibility to you?
It's right up there with one of the top key sort of asks that me personally I asked for, and Deadly Connection is supportive of. I actually got to travel 2 years ago to Geneva to address the Human Rights Council to lean on our government to raise the age of criminal responsibility. And I think what the community and society need to understand that, you know, not every 10-year-old is out committing burglaries or murdering people. So some young people who end up in detention centres and juvenile detention centres are there because they run away a lot. They're not safe in the placement they're in. They're in out of home care, and these children need somewhere to be housed and facilitated. So the interim is custodial. So you don't even have to commit an offence to spend time in a prison cell as a young person. And the other thing needs to be said, that if we're going to charge and incriminate young children as young as 10, what are we going to do to get them jobs and employment when they're coming out of that? There is no pathway from prison to employment and housing.
Well, fancy a kid of that age having a criminal record. Any opportunities open to him would evaporate.
Yeah, of course. And the research tells us that these young people who have criminal records, like myself, then become dependent on welfare benefits and social housing, which then becomes a society problem. So if we can empower our children and the government to raise the age and support young people and divert them and give them the skills, then we won't have to pay taxes to be able to support them day to day. You know, they will contribute to society, they will get jobs, they will feel normal, they'll find their identity, they'll be connected to their country, to their family, to their culture, and they'll be active participating citizens of the community.
Tony, back to you. Earlier this year, the Morrison government unveiled the new National Agreement on Closing the Gap, included targets to reduce the overrepresentation of both adults and young people in the criminal justice system. And I think the figure was by 15 and 30% respectively, by, I should add, 2031. A belated step in the right direction, Tony?
Many people within the justice sector have been arguing that the Close the Gap process, if it was to continue, needed to include appropriate justice targets. And we were pleased to hear that that was going to happen. I was disappointed, as were the organisations I work with, the New South Wales Bar Association and the Law Council of Australia, at the unambitious target in respect of adult incarceration in particular. The target of 15% would mean parity with the rest of the country by 2093, That figure is unacceptable. And what we've seen in the last 10 months, during the first period of the COVID restrictions between March and June, I think, a three-month period, in New South Wales, we saw an 11% reduction in the incarceration rate just over that period through a number of processes, including the adjournment of matters in court, granting of police bail, granting of court bail, and that alone reduced the numbers significantly. And it shows that, in my view, that the target of 15% is way too unambitious.
Tony, you've mentioned a couple of times now the importance of reforming bail laws. What about a wider rollout of justice reinvestment programs?
I think that program has incredible potential for the Aboriginal community because it draws together all the things that the community are saying. The justice reinvestment model, and there is a model in operation in Bourke, is one in which the community leads the programs. The community leads the reform and engages with the government agencies and indicates what it needs. And that's what the community has been asking for. That program in Bourke has been reported upon by KPMG. It's been found to have made significant savings for the government, well above and beyond the government expenditure necessary for the program. And it seems to me that the only reason that it isn't being rolled out is a lack of political will. And I'm yet to get to the bottom of why that political will isn't there.
I have to congratulate the three of you on your heroic efforts in fighting the good fight, and I have to thank you very much for finding the time for the program. Tony McAvoy, SC, barrister and co-chair of the Indigenous Legal Issues Committee of the Law Council of Australia. Dr. Hannah McGlade, Associate Professor at the Curtin University School of Law and, yes, expert member of the UN Permanent Forum for Indigenous Issues. And congratulations to you, Keenan Mundine, co-founder of the non-profit organisation that produces great, great social profits for Australia, Deadly Connections. Tony, Hannah, Keenan, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.